I drink your milkshake. I drink it all up.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are, this is Eric.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road. And, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight, we talk about the Paul Thomas Anderson film, There Will Be Blood, from 2007, starring Paul F. Tompkins.
Oh, and of course, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Well, he's in there too.
Yeah, just in a minor role.
Actually, there's not very many actors in this movie.
No.
So whose movie is this officially on the list?
Mine.
Okay, so Jason, why are we watching this movie?
I love this movie. I think this is a great movie. That's why.
Okay. Drew, you have initial thoughts about this movie?
Yeah, so I watched it when it first came out on video, which is a number of years ago. And I've had some significant changes in my life, which really give me a whole different perspective on the movie. For one, I'm a father, and I wasn't before. And for another, I work for the oil industry, and I didn't before. So that was, it gave me a little bit different perspective. So I'm looking forward to chatting about this movie.
Excellent. Yeah, actually, Daniel Plainview became medium oil.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. So excellent. Well, I had never seen it until last night. I finished it.
Have you seen any Paul Thomas Anderson movies?
I saw Magnolia. That's one of his, right?
Mm-hmm. But you haven't seen Boogie Nights?
No. I haven't seen it.
Punch Drunk Love?
Nope. I understand. Now, when is on our calendar? When is No Country for Old Men? Is that next?
Two weeks from today, because I am out next week.
Okay. And what are we doing next week? Is it In and Out?
Should be In and Out.
Okay. All right. Originally it was No Country for Old Men right after this, right?
Yes, that was the plan,
and that was on purpose, right?
Yes.
Because Roger Ebert liked this movie a whole lot, There Will Be Blood, but said that, you know, at the same time, in basically the same desert, they were filming this movie called No Country for Old Men, and where There Will Be Blood was a good movie, No Country for Old Men is a great movie. Hmm.
They were filming it at the same time?
Yes. In fact, the oil fire screwed up, the oil fire from There Will Be Blood screwed up the actual set, the shooting for No Country for Old Men. Because there's gigantic cloud of smoke in the background.
Right. Huh, that's funny.
Didn't No Country for Old Men come out? I have the perception that it came out much later.
No, in fact, they were up. It won for Best Picture.
Huh, okay. Yeah. Well, that was my perception.
They were up against each other. Forever linked in my mind. That's funny that they were shooting in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So I'm looking forward to going back to see that movie. Yeah, so wasn't sure whether Brother Jay had seen this movie before, so I got about 45 minutes into it and texted him, "Hey, have you started this yet? Because if you know, the underlying message was, if you haven't, you better start it right away because it's a long movie." And he was like, "Yeah, I've watched it twice. I'll probably watch it a third time before." And he had seen it before even that. So Brother Jay is the expert on this one.
I love this movie. I think it's a great movie.
Cool.
First of all, I will say that I predicted on the outset in my notes the opening of this movie. I'm like, this is a very 2001 opening. Eric will hate the opening of this movie, I predict.
I didn't hate it. I thought it was very interesting, and it was very 2001 in that no one talked for 14 minutes.
Yeah, I actually made a note of that. 15 minutes with no dialogue.
Well, yeah. It's very 2001-y, but it's also very the mechanic-y.
I have not seen The Mechanic.
The Charles Bronson movie?
Oh, wait, I have seen The Mechanic.
Yeah, we watched it together when I was way too young.
Well, I haven't seen it in a very long time, that one. That's the one with Jack Palance, right?
Mm, sounds right.
Yeah. There's a very great scene in that movie.
But that movie feels like 20 minutes with no talking to start off.
Yeah, well, that was the idea, was that there would be no talking for a very long time, which is why the sound design in this movie was so important, which is the main thing I want to talk about from my angle, is the sound design in this movie. I don't know why they didn't win the Academy Award for it. They should have won every sound award. Editing,
yeah.
Score, everything.
Absolutely.
Because the sound was a character in this movie.
Yes.
And a lot of the, you know, because there's not a ton of action. There's some action. There's not a ton of action, though. But the movie moves along because of this unsettling score. It really ramps up tension just by the score itself. And are you familiar with the artist who did the score?
Nope.
Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, he...
that makes so much sense, though.
In fact, one of the instruments he used is called the Ondas Martineau, which is, he said it was, it's kind of fudging the timeline because it really wasn't popular or in main service until the late 20s, but there are some early 20s examples of the Ondas Martineau, and the Ondas Martineau has a keyboard. It looks a little bit like an organ. It has a keyboard, but it's also a combination like piano theremin.
Awesome.
So is that the instrument that made that really disorienting sound?
I believe so. Like the buzzing bees kind of sound?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was it. Because that sound was so disquieting.
It was like 100 violins mistuned being strung at the same time.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So effective at making you, as the audience, even more uncomfortable watching some really uncomfortable scenes.
Oh yeah,
it really puts you on edge.
And so. I'll have to watch it again, but it was kind of a music cue also, when things were starting to ramp up. That buzzing sound started to overtake you. And it wasn't just underlying. It got louder and louder. And I'm sure in the theater, it was crazy.
I will say that on rewatch and rewatch and rewatch, I'm still getting things in this movie. There's so much here. There's just so much depth and layers that it really is kind of a great movie to watch again and again.
Well,
although you have to be having a good day.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Because I've thoughts about that. I have questions, actually. I have thoughts that will turn into questions. I have stories that will turn into questions. The other thing I want to mention about the sound was, besides all of the strings and piano and violins and then this Martineau thing, there was this tremendous percussion part of the movie. Like this whole setup that almost sounded like tribal jungle drums and stuff. That reminded me so much of the Fleetwood Mac song Tusk. Are you familiar with Tusk?
I am familiar with Tusk.
I'm very familiar with Tusk.
Do you like Tusk?
Yes, very much so.
We just had an episode where I talked about amazing pilots. And there is a pilot episode for the show The Americans that uses the song Tusk to great effect. It is amazing.
I have it on my computer. I haven't watched it yet.
I'm going to have to watch it just for that, because Tusk is... this movie made me look into the song Tusk. It's an amazing song. It was Mick Fleetwood was going to do it for his own solo album. And... it ended up being a Fleetwood Mac song when it all, you know, came out, because the riff itself, I guess, was a riff that Lindsey Buckingham would just use for sound checks. So it was just kind of a common riff that was just sort of hanging around. And then Mick Fleetwood put a bunch of drums in it. And I'll have a quote here that from Mick Fleetwood. I'm playing floor toms, and I overdub a lot of American Indian wood tribal drums. It's a whole hodgepodge of Kleenex boxes, drums, weird stuff. He was slapping, he had a big leg of lamb that he was hitting with a spatula. And Lindsey Buckingham was smacking on a Kleenex box at one point for percussion.
Wow, those were the days.
Plus, there's also, yeah, and they did this with you know, analog equipment. So they had to actually cut together and splice tapes and remix things. And
I wonder exactly how much blow you have to do to think smacking a lamb with a spatula is going to do it for you. I mean, not that it didn't work. I'm just saying, though.
Yeah. The other thing about Tusk that I found really disturbing is Tusk ended up on a cassette that I, back when I was a teenager, I would try to go to sleep listening to music. Turns out it's always, for me, it's a that's a losing battle because I'll either get into the song or it'll just incorporate in my dreams. And I've got a couple of stories about waking up to clock radios, why I could only use, I can only listen to talk radio as a alarm radio, like a radio alarm clock thing. But oh, that's for another point.
I'm abundantly aware of your alarm clock habits having yeah. shared a wall with you for years and true. Years and years.
But in the beginning of Tusk, there's like dogs barking. I think like stadium sounds maybe, or maybe I'm just bleeding the video onto the into the audio, because the video for Tusk has them all setting up at, I think, USC Stadium with the USC marching band. And I guess was it John McVie was gone during the making of the video, and so Mick Fleetwood had like a life-size cutout of him that he drug around. So, very interesting stuff.
I think you would dig the first episode of The Americans.
If it's anything, if it's an, like to me, the high water mark for effective use of music has got to be Inagata De Vita during Manhunter.
I'd say it's comparable.
Yeah, okay.
I hate that song.
It's on Amazon Prime if you're a Prime user.
Yeah, yeah.
You can watch it for free.
Excellent. Well, and if it's only the pilot, I'll just watch that first one. And if I like it, great. If I don't, that's fine too.
It's probably the best show on television right now.
Now that Scandal is off the air. No, not Scandal. Yeah. The Good Wife.
Never seen The Good Wife.
They canceled The Cape.
Yeah. Yeah, now The Cape is gone.
I love The Good Wife, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No,
I'm sorry to see it go.
To There Will Be Blood, Daniel Plainview, who is played by Daniel Day-Lewis. I'll have to admit that I had forgotten that, and because he's so grubby and bearded for the first half an hour, maybe actually the first 40 minutes, maybe actually until I talked to our mom the next day, did I realize it wasn't Christian Bale.
Oh, wow.
Because he doesn't talk, so there's no way to know.
Well, when he does talk, he could be Christian Bale.
Yeah, well, he could definitely be Batman. I mean, I think Daniel Day-Lewis could be Batman.
I think you're right. He may have been a better Batman.
I think Daniel Day-Lewis is a really good actor, but I find most of his performances really uncomfortable to watch.
Well, but that doesn't make him a bad actor.
No, I said he's a really good actor. He's just not really enjoyable.
Oh, well, but do you think that lent itself to this role? Do you think it aided him in this role?
Absolutely. I mean, he transformed himself into Daniel Plainview. I mean, he had so many just like physical tics. He had like the one weird squinty eye, and he had the gimpy leg that he limped around on for the entire movie.
Yeah.
I think is a callback to the very first scene. And as he degenerated throughout the course of the movie, his whole physical appearance changed. Like, he started to hunch more, started to hobble around more. I mean, he did a fantastic job, but,
and he maintained his voice.
Yes.
The voice is such an iconic voice, such a successful piece of business.
Yeah. It's not even just the sound of his voice. It's his, like, his weird, like, sociopathic cadence.
Yes. And the language, the choice of language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even that, even the milkshake quote, turns out, do you know where that comes from?
No.
In the teapot dome scandal of the early 1900s, in the U.S. Congress, they were actually talking about, was it drainage? And there was a member of Congress who actually used the milkshake analogy, like, contemporaneous to that time. So as soon as I think it was Paul Thomas Anderson read that, he's like, oh, no, we have to use the word milkshake. And then, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis saying the word milkshake in that voice is just incredible. I mean, and, you know, because you don't hear from Daniel Plainview for a good 15 minutes, you don't realize what he is going to sound like. He could sound like Batman, but when you first hear him talk, he is very articulate. I mean, he may be in a grubby business, but he is an educated man.
Yeah, he's very smart. He uses unusual choices for his vocabulary. And then when he's in total, like, doesn't give a fuck mode, he's just, it's not quite monotone, but it's this weird affect that he uses to convey that he doesn't give two shits about what's going on around him. Yeah, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but, like, after the big well blowout, and his son is injured, and after they finally get it under control to the point where he can relax, his right hand man is like,
HW, okay?
Oh, yes.
And it was just, he said it in such a weird manner. But just the way he said those words conveyed everything that he was feeling at that moment, and it wasn't anything about the welfare of his son. Even though he was a pretty loving father throughout most of this movie, at that moment he was just totally consumed with the success of this one oil well. And he conveyed all of that in just the way he said those words.
Yeah, he knew how to put a period at the end of a sentence. Not an exclamation mark, but just a very firm period.
A period the size of Nebraska.
Yeah. That's why the English refer to that as a full stop.
It's a very good way to put it.
Yeah. So, anyway, so shall we dive into the plot?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a big plot.
Well, it's a big plot, but it's a small story. I mean, it's pretty well contained with very few but very rich characters. That's how I would describe it.
Yeah.
So the year 1898. And let me point out, I like this movie quite a bit. I'm not sure I'm satisfied with anything about it. When it all comes down to it, I'm going to have you guys tell me what I missed in it. But I don't like period pieces, but I enjoyed every minute of this movie. The period did not get in the way. In fact, it actually enhanced it. Maybe because I don't mind period pieces where people are grubby. Maybe I just don't like fancy dress-up period pieces.
Well, and because it's so easy to have made this a pretty legitimate-looking period piece, because you didn't have to recreate too much of a bare bones of a small town that hadn't existed yet. And you didn't have to go back and create a lot of, you know, buildings and historical places, and, you know, you didn't have to have a lot of vehicles, for one. You know, so there wasn't a lot of set dressing and period pieces that you had to kind of reproduce and get right, because a lot of it was just wide open land and oil derricks and crappy, you know, construct buildings.
Anyway, so the year is 1898, and we see Daniel Plainview, a prospector in New Mexico.
Plainview.
What did I call him?
Plainville.
Okay, sorry. Perhaps like, I will start
like,
again.
Like Whoville or Pleasantville?
Yes.
Your favorite movie,
Labudores. So, in 1898, Daniel Plainview, a prospector in New Mexico, is working his mine, and he's got just like a pit mine, and he's working it all by himself in a very scary-looking existence. And we find out that there are consequences to working by yourself.
I mean, he's looking for minerals, right? Not yes, oil.
Correct.
Yeah, it looks like he's looking for some kind of flint or pyrite or...
Yeah, he ends up finding some silver and some gold. But yeah, he has an accident involving dynamite. And, well, actually, he has an accident involving slipping and falling.
Yeah. But didn't you expect it when, as he's trying to pull the bucket up, after he's lit the dynamite, by the way, in the most nonchalant way to get out of a mine shaft, when he's lit a stick of dynamite, he's just kind of like sauntering up the, up the ladder. Didn't you expect the bucket to catch the dynamite and him to pull it up and just explode in his face, Wile E. Coyote style?
I had not considered that, although I expected the bucket to become a projectile that would come raining down upon him.
Yes, that's what I expected.
But no, so he falls from a broken rung of a ladder and breaks his leg. And but it turns out he finds some sort of ore, a vein of ore. And so he crawls his ass up out of the pit and presumably drags it all the way to the assaying office, where he is lying down on the assaying office floor as they are doing whatever they do to find out the chemical composition of this ore.
They're proofing his stash.
Yeah, and this scene was badass from a cinematography standpoint, because for the entirety of the scene, it's this really close shot of him in the mine or really close to the mine, and it isn't until he is down at the bottom of the mine with a broken leg, and he, in like the most painful manner, has to crawl up the ladder out of it and starts, kind of shimmying on his backside away from the hole. Then the camera like pans out and you get like the first wide shot, and it shows he is out in the middle of nowhere. And if he is sliding his butt and his back all the way, that is at least tens of miles, if not more than that.
In the hot desert sun.
Right.
Followed by the cold desert night. So.
Yes. So this is not a normal dude.
Oh, no. he's that wiry, tough type. Actually, he may be like the ultimate man character, like the ultimate masculine character.
Yeah. He's dad.
Yeah.
There were a lot of similarities.
And now you know why I love this movie.
Yeah. Well,
should probably have been our Father's Day movie, but we've got heat.
Actually, this is an hour too long for our Father's Day movie.
Actually, it's actually like so 2 hours too long.
So for is her. He, actually. We go to 1902, and he discovers oil somewhere near Los Angeles, and establishes a small drilling company. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but is he drilling for oil by basically taking a big metal spear and lifting it up high and letting it fall down until it digs into the ground that way?
Yep.
That was unintentional though, right?
Yeah.
They weren't even looking for oil. I think they were still mining for silver.
Right. They were.
And they accidentally dropped that drill bit. And when they dropped, that's what created the first fissure that allowed some oil to bubble up.
And that's where they anointed the baby with oil.
Yes, this baby that just sort of appears on screen. Now, it's presumably the guy who gets killed.
It is his baby.
His baby, okay. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Turns out Daniel adopts him. He becomes HW. who is his son and business partner. And he also allows him to, of course, now he's a family man. So he ends up, this is where he actually, I think this is the Paul F. Tompkins part, where he goes into town and tries to get a community to let him drill on their property. I'll give him a lease. And there's just too much confusion, so he totally blows them off.
I don't need the lease, thank you.
We need you. We need you.
Too much confusion. Thank you for your time.
No. There's no confusion.
I wouldn't take the lease if you gave it to me as a gift.
But we get the great Paul F. Tompkins line, the line of the entire movie. We will gain nothing by losing our heads. It's a great line.
I had no idea that was Paul F. Tompkins.
Yes. And you wouldn't if you weren't looking for him, probably. Although his voice is very distinctive. So you hear him, like, in the background. It's not everybody's like, broccoli, broccoli, rutabaga, rutabaga, rutabaga. And you hear Paul Tompkins going, calm down now. But yeah, so then he is obviously established now. He's got a small drilling company, and he's produced a well, the Coyote Well, right?
Yes.
He is approached by a young man by the name of Paul Sunday. This is in 1911. And Paul Sunday wants him to pay him for a tip on where there's some oil.
$500.
Yes. And like most of the dialogue of this movie, it's pretty crisp. And it's, you know, because partly because Daniel Plainview is such a, his voice is so rich that any kind of conversation he's involved in gets your attention.
He also doesn't use a lot of extra words. There's not a lot of extemporaneous exposition on his part.
Yeah, this is a nice little scene where we find out that turns out this Paul Sunday may actually have a lead on some oil. And he actually talks Plainview into doing a deal. Although at first he does ask Plainview what church he belongs to. And Plainview gives a very Sarah Palin answer to it. All of them. I like all of them. Yeah, so then we have Daniel and HW going on a quail hunting trip to find this place in, was it Little Boston?
Subterfuge.
Yes. So he's going up to hunt quail, and HW actually asked him in a funny scene, or interesting scene, how much they're going to pay him, and Plainview says, well, we're not going to give him oil prices. We're going to give him quail prices.
And again, he used that weird affect where it wasn't like, he wasn't like a villain, like twirling his mustache. He just like said it so matter of factly.
It was business. It was just this business acumen.
He's just this
matter of
almost
fact,
autistic sociopath who has no concern for other people.
Well, and you also learn that he's something of a salesman. I mean, this speech that he gave in front of Paul F. Tompkins' group is a very similar to a speech he gives to the Little Boston group. And you feel like he's used this sort of speech before. He's definitely a salesman as much as an oil driller. But anyway, so Daniel goes up there and meets with the Sundays. And we meet Eli, who is Paul's twin brother. By the way, they weren't intentionally twin brothers in the script, but because was it Paul Dano who plays Eli and Paul?
Mm-hmm.
Because he did such a good job, they just decided to give him the Eli role as well as the Paul role.
I think the first time I watched this movie, for the entire time, I thought it was going to be some sort of reveal that there was no brother.
Oh, that would have been an interesting twist.
Does Paul ever show back up? He doesn't, right? He's just in he's in that one scene and out.
Yep, and yep. He's talked about at the very end, but yeah, he doesn't. Mm-hmm. You never see him again, and they don't do that Patty Duke show, like Mirror, where they both come together, which is good. Probably good choice on P.T. Anderson's part.
So, I think he could have pulled it off.
I'm sure. So yeah, Eli poses a little bit extra problem for Daniel Plainview in that he is. He wants $10,000 for his church, and eventually he's promised $5,000, And Plainview, in the meantime, starts buying up properties all around the area. And there's one holdout, and that's the Bandy property, that Bandy wants to meet with him in person. But Plainview is like, he's just trying to jack up the price. And so kind of blows him off.
Yeah, so Plainview has this notion. He has a feeling that this is going to be a really good producing property. And this is one of the things he talked to HW about, is that when they produce a well, they spend a lot of money on transportation costs over the railroad because the railroad is owned by Standard Oil. I think if I remember, that's a type of, what, like vertical monopoly, right? That Standard Oil had. And so Daniel's idea was to build a pipeline out to the ocean and sell directly to Union Oil. So to build this pipeline, he needed to buy up the property, or at least lease the property in order to run a pipeline over it. So that's what he started to do. Yeah, and the Bandy Tract was one of the bigger acreages, and that was a holdout. But he didn't need that until he had the well producing, which is still going to be a while.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, because eventually it's a problem, but for the moment, we just had to figure out how to get the oil and how big the oil is going to be. And right. Standard Oil has already bought some property around, and Plainview gets there first to actually do some drilling, but because that's actually his MO. He can get there fast. Part of his sales pitch is he has the tools, and he can come in 10 days and start drilling. And he's not going to leave, he's not going to have a bunch of half-assed newbie guys making mistakes. He knows how to get the job done. At least that's his sales pitch. So he gets there.
He is medium oil.
He is, yeah. No, he goes in there. He sets it all up. And by the way, medium oil, I got confused once because Brother Jew works for a company that describes himself as medium oil, meaning not big oil.
I describe us as medium oil.
Oh, okay.
So when they head up to the Sunday Ranch, and they're pretty, they're met with open arms from the Sunday family. They're offered potato and milk and water, which is pretty generous for these strangers that just basically come squatting across their property. But then you have the scene of HW running around with the rifle randomly, just like shooting. Ostensibly he's shooting at quail, but you don't know what he's shooting at. There's just this little kid with this rifle.
Ah, but this was a time where little kids had rifles.
Yeah, and just, you put your eye out.
Yeah, it was okay to be Yosemite Sam back in the day.
And the chance of hitting another person is very, very low if you're out in the middle of nowhere. And shallow graves are easy to dig, as it turns out.
I don't think it was that easy.
Yeah. But it's that kind of shows the build of this father-son relationship. They're out there camping, and Daniel is instructing HW on certain things and giving him instruction, but also saying, "Well, what do you think that is? You tell me."
Oh, that was a good Daniel Plainview.
Yeah,
I was gonna say,
that's pretty nice.
But yeah, Plainview is in a lot of ways, he's a really terrific father. up until when he's not.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, he seems to. Yeah, he does all the right things.
Especially considering that this is basically a kid that he's adopted, and so his father instinct, he had to really cultivate that.
Oh yeah, well, and actually, this is a movie with very few women. And no love interest for Daniel Plainview.
Yeah.
Because he tells people that that HW's wife died in childbirth.
HW's mother.
HW's mother. Sorry. Daniel Plain Pants, H.G. Wells's brother. Yeah, anyway, so. Sorry.
SpongeBob Plainview Pants.
Exactly. Anyway, back to Eli for a second. Eli is demanding this money for the church. And Plainview is really pretty matter-of-fact about all this church stuff, too. He's like, okay, I get your game. That's a good one. Well played, son. I'll give you $5,000 for your church and, whatever. But then we find out, as things are progressing in Little Boston, we find out that Eli is a preacher in the church and is a faith healer.
He is a batshit snake oil salesman.
My dear Mrs. Hunter, you have arthritis, don't you?
Yes, I do, Eli.
Yes, the devil is in your hands and I will suck it out. Now, I will not cast this ghost out with a fever, for the new spirit inside me has shown me I have a new way to communicate. It is a gentle whisper. Get out of here, ghost. Get out of here, ghost. Get out. Get out of here, ghost. Get out of here, ghost. Get out of here, ghost. Get out of here. Don't you dare turn around and come back. For if you do, all the armies of my boot will kick you in the teeth. And you will be cast up and thrown in the dirt and thrust back to perdition. And as long as I have teeth, I will bite you. And if I have no teeth, I will gum you. And as long as I have fish, I will bash you. Now get out of here, ghost. Get out of here, ghost. Get out of here, ghost. And it left!
Hallelujah! Yes!
Hallelujah. Yes.
Praise the Lord!
His holy name!
Amen!
Thank you! Thank you! My dear Mrs.
Hunter. Paul Dano does such a good job because Eli is not a likable character.
Nope.
He is like, I can't remember his name, but I guess what, Malachi from Children of the Corn. I mean, he is snivelly and whiny and weaselly, and it turns out a faith healer. And I had to rewind this movie, which is a little bit hard on the iPod, turns out, to rewind to an exact spot, like four times. Because when he's doing his little faith healing, he says to Mrs. Hunter that...
You have arthritis, don't you?
Yes, I do, Eli.
Yes, the devil is in your hands and I will suck it out.
The devil is in your hands and I will blank it out.
Yes, the devil is in your hands and I will suck it out.
And I thought he actually was saying that he was going to fuck it out of her. I will insert the clip in here because I swear to God, I had to rewind it so many times.
The devil is in your hands and I will suck it out.
IMDb tells me that the quote is, I will suck it out.
And I will suck it out.
Come on, this is the early 1900s.
And I will suck it out.
They had the F word in the early 1900s. Have you not seen Deadwood?
And I will suck it out.
He's got good words too. He talks about how he's going to get the devil out. As long as I have teeth, I will bite you. And if I have no teeth, I will gum you. That is some crazy batshit stuff. It reminds me a little bit of like that whole Jim Jones, Dr. Gene Scott, Robert Tilton kind of thing.
Overwrought preacher man who's lost his temper.
Yeah, Sam Kinison kind of stuff.
Sam Kinison was a preacher.
Oh, yeah.
I decided that Paul Dano improvised this.
Oh, I hope so.
It's probably not true, but that increases my enjoyment of the scene.
Turns out Paul Dano plays some really unlikable characters.
Have you seen a preview for his movie coming out, Swiss Army Man?
No.
He plays a shipwrecked guy who's trying to make it home with the help of the corpse of Harry Potter.
Sweet. So, kind of like, what is it called? The Black Sails comic book within a comic book in The Watchmen?
It's more of a fantasy than that. It's called Swiss Army Man because this corpse can do a bunch of different things.
Awesome.
It's a bonkers trailer that you should take a look at.
So it should be a double feature with that Michael Shannon movie that just came out, Midnight Special.
That seems like it'd be a really hard right turn at some point.
Oh, he was in that Daniel Craig Cowboys and Aliens.
Paul Dano?
Yeah.
I always remember him from Little Miss Sunshine.
He was like the suicidal brother guy?
Oh, he played Alexander in Where the Wild Things Are as a voice actor.
Hmm. Yeah, he's got some cred.
I think his first word in Little Miss Sunshine was screaming fuck at the top of his lungs.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Oh, he was in Long Island Expressway. That's where I reckon. All right.
I have no idea what that is, but
with Brian Cox?
Yeah. Have you seen Long Island Expressway?
Mm-hmm.
Oh God.
Give me a thumbnail. What's Long Island Expressway?
It's about a kid who's having a rough time with his family's dynamic of being divorced, and kind of as a adolescent, confused, potentially gay teenager, and ends up falling into a kind of this troublemaker clique, not the least of which turns out to be like this child molester, Brian Cox.
Oh, great.
It's a love story.
it's a good movie, but it's one of those, like, I've seen it once and I probably won't watch it again. I own it, incidentally, but I don't think I'll watch it again.
Yep.
Eli, not only is he a faith healer, but Eli tends to get what Eli wants to get. So, he comes up to Plainview, and I guess they're going to be beginning drilling in earnest, and he wants to bless the well.
So as like part of community outreach, Plainview is, you know, having this little ceremony to kick off the drilling of the well, and so he's inviting the community and making a show of it.
Well, I think he knows that if he engages the town and makes it known to the town the benefits that he's going to bring by this well and the pomp and circumstance that comes along with it and all the trappings of riches, that the town will buy off on it. And then if there's any problems, the town will help. Or, you know, if there's any obstruction, that perhaps the town will help smooth that. So he's really kind of brilliant in that way.
Oh, yeah. Setting the model for all oil companies to follow.
Of course. Yeah. So Plainview is very nice to Eli and asked him what time is good for him and says, okay, my thanks for your visit.
Yeah. Eli is certainly self-important.
Yes. Unfortunately, Eli finds out quickly that Plainview does what Plainview wants to do. So Plainview has a little speech and ends up, while Eli is standing there waiting to be introduced for the blessing, Daniel Plainview just gives the blessing on his own.
Yeah, he gives Eli the shaft.
That's an oil joke.
Yeah, it's a mining or something. And then oil production begins, and we have a horrible accident, a gas blowout, and it kills a worker. Actually, the worker died. Sorry, there was a death at the mine first.
Well, it wasn't the mine. It was at well.
Not the mine. Oh, sorry.
In the well cellar.
Yeah, in the well cellar.
Yeah, so there was a death. Then there was eventually a gas blowout. And that's where HW loses his hero.
Oh, and Daniel is drinking more and more. Either he's drinking more and more or they're showing it more and more.
Yeah, it seems to be that he's drinking more and more.
He's also, you know, awoken in the middle of the night a lot. Or he's like, mm-hmm. The thing about this movie is he is certainly, he may be like leading the group, but he's not afraid of getting dirty himself.
No, he is a working manager.
Yes.
Another hallmark of medium oil. But yeah, so HW is actually like looking down into the well cellar when they hit a pocket of gas. And that's pretty horrific.
You having children, you would never allow that, would you?
No.
Yeah.
Like OSHA wouldn't actually allow that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, there's so many things about this whole setup.
Well, the other thing I wrote down was, you know, at one point they're ironsmithing, like right there on the active drilling platform.
Oh yeah, no, they have people smoking when they're producing a very flammable substance.
So I was drawn aback. I'm like, they're irons, but like the guy's got the anvil and he's pounding out the metal that's glowing red cherry hot. I'm just, yeah, no.
Yeah. Attitudes about safety were a little different back then.
Eli comes to, not so subtly, he tries to. Not so subtly suggest that they wouldn't have had accidents if there had been a proper blessing of the well. But Plainview wants none of that.
Yeah, I think I cut you off, but in the accident, HW loses his hearing. It's pretty devastating to watch as the audience, because on one hand, Daniel really cares about his well-being, but on the other hand, he's got to go take care of this well, which is gushing oil, much to his delight.
Yes. And on fire, which turns out to be a smaller problem than all that.
Which has the most best awesome use of barrels and dynamite I've ever seen in a movie.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's how they would actually kill a well, but it made for great film. That was awesome. I don't care if it was accurate or not. I choose that it was accurate. The giant barrels of dynamite that they just roll into the fire.
On big sticks?
Yeah.
I think BP tried that in the Gulf, but they found out quickly that that doesn't work so well out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, Eli, during the whole thing where he mentions I don't know, it could have not had the tragedy had it been properly blessed. And oh, by the way, the church is growing and we need more room. So there's some little back and forth between Eli and Plainview.
Well, he wants that $5,000 that Plainview still hasn't given him.
Yes. Well, eventually he actually walks across past a little oil pond or whatever, and confronts Plainview directly and wants his $5,000. And that's when we learn that Daniel Plainview is, like, the most masculine man ever. Because if there's one thing it's sort of satisfying to see is a snivelly, whiny little guy get his ass kicked by a manly man who wants none of it.
Well, I think the symbolism is that Daniel baptizes Eli in the runoff.
Yeah. But also suggests that, you know, Eli is a healer and a vessel for the Holy Spirit. So why isn't he coming over to make his son hear again?
Yeah, and he beats him in a manner that is so condescending, because he doesn't ever like punch him. He just like open hand slaps the crap out of him.
Oh yes.
Yeah, but not just once, repeatedly.
Oh, yeah.
As you would a child or a woman. In 1911.
Yeah, I mean, if it was like in The Gift, you would just punch a woman in the stomach.
Exactly, yes.
You would need a slapper.
But yeah, so he slaps the crap out of Eli. And then Eli, being, again, a Weasley coward guy, he takes it out on someone not his own size, his elderly father. Presumably his father, right?
Yeah.
And berates his father for being a stupid man. So that's not very nice.
Yeah, I don't know where that is in your Bible.
Yeah, yeah. So there we learn that, you know, of course, Eli is the villain in this. And then, and of course, we have the tragedy with Daniel Plainview and his son. And then we have a mysterious stranger who arrives at Daniel's doorstep.
The long lost brother.
His long lost brother by another mother.
Yeah.
And of course, I don't have the actor's name written down.
Yeah, who was that? He was good.
He was good.
Kevin J. O'Connor, I think, because it's Henry, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Kevin J. O'Connor.
Okay, yes. Does a great job. He arrives at Daniel's doorstep.
Ooh, that's an unfortunate IMDb picture. Ooh.
And, he says he's his half-brother, Henry. And he's had some tough times, but, you know, was hoping to get to meet his brother and get closer. And so Daniel hires him to work, and they do grow closer.
You need to check out Kevin J. O'Connor's IMDb page. He has some interesting choices.
Oh, do tell.
Flight of the Living Dead, Seraphim Falls, Van Helsing.
Oh, I love Seraphim Falls.
Are you joking?
No.
You've actually seen Seraphim Falls?
Yeah, isn't that the Pierce Brosnan, Liam Neeson movie? Angelica Houston, right?
I don't know. I'll have to look. I haven't seen it, so one second.
If it turns out you're making all this up, I'm going to be so impressed.
No.
Liam Neeson, Pierce Brosnan, Xander Berkeley.
Wow.
Angelica Houston.
Come on, Angelica Houston. Yeah.
Angie Harmon. Wow. Good job.
I want to say Angelica Houston played the devil.
Madame Louise.
Louise Cipher.
Yeah. Wow. That looks like quite the movie.
So is it a place called Seraphim Falls? Are there angels?
I think it's a place. It's a Western.
Okay. Is it like a play on words? Like The Fallen Angels?
That movie is heavy with metaphors.
Okay. All right.
But really fun.
Wow, it did terrible.
Seraphim Falls?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a weirdo movie.
It was budgeted for $18 million, and the gross was, half a million.
So I was one of the three people who saw it.
Yeah, the opening weekend was $155,000.
Wow, I wonder if this was one of those write-off movies.
It must have been. Sorry for the interlude. I was looking at his IMDb page, and he was in The Mummy in 1999, and Amistad. He's just had some strange roles.
Well, good for him.
He was in FX2.
I remember FX1. That was a strange movie.
Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, that was on heavy multivisions rotation.
I like that movie.
I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through.
Anyway, sorry, I digress.
So back to,
Brother Henry shows up.
And it turns out HW does not take a liking to Brother Henry.
What would give you that idea?
Oh, I don't know, the fact that he tried to burn the house down to kill him.
And did you think Daniel was going to beat the crap out of HW?
I did.
Yes. Yeah, but he didn't.
By the way, at this point, he's now giving HW alcoholic milkshakes.
Oh, yeah. They're hoping that he can have his hearing restored, but, it's not looking good. And I like the method of when the doctor comes, where he just grabs HW and, like, throttles him and so that the doctor can get a look inside the ears.
Yeah, this is something I did not understand. Did HW not know how to read or write?
I don't think he did.
Good question.
Because there was never really any school for him. He was always with his dad.
Well, but his dad was a man of reading and writing.
Yeah, Daniel could read and write, but...
And had excellent penmanship in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he never tried to use that as a communication tool for HW after he lost his hearing. Well, he just kept trying to talk to him.
But here you have Daniel, who's been basically oil well after oil well after oil well, and then adopts a kid... And continues on after oil well after oil well. He probably didn't put HW in school. He's just dragging him. That's why he's trying to teach him the business.
It does have a question. Because eventually HW gets a much better education.
He is showing him. I mean, he does show him charts and things. So, I mean, ostensibly he does read and write some. But
you think
maybe
all
he
would need was a small chalkboard.
Maybe.
To solve some of his problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, even Mary Ingalls had a chalkboard, and she was blind. I think they called it a slate.
While Daniel might be a great salesman, he is not a great communicator.
So, so Daniel decides to solve a couple of problems. He sends HW away to a school for the deaf in San Francisco. And he's taking him there on the train, but then, of course, he deserts him on the train, which I thought was particularly cruel and difficult to watch, but difficult for him as well.
Yeah, I think he couldn't face his son and sending him away. And so rather than dealing with it, he just, like, you know, in some ways, not equivalent, but it's the same, you know, in the movie Sneakers, where Ben Kingsley is, I cannot kill my friend. You know, I can't accompany my child, so I can't bear to see this, so you see it through.
I thought more of Turtle from the movie Daryl. All right, never mind.
Crickets.
Yeah, sorry. I got nothing. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Yeah, so that leaves Daniel to focus on the oil business, and Standard Oil offers to buy him out. For what, $1 million, right? Or $1.5 million? But Daniel doesn't like that.
Well, and they made the mistake of bringing up his son.
Exactly, yes. And Daniel doesn't like having his parenting methods criticized. And also suggests to the Standard Oil representative that he's going to go to his house at night and cut his throat. It's like, what? Excuse me? Wait, hold on. Back up a little bit. What are you going to do? Yeah.
Yeah, because the Standard guy was his suggestion is pretty innocuous. It was like, take this money, you'll be rich, and then you can spend time with your family instead of working so hard.
Yeah, we can make you a millionaire before you leave the room.
Yes. So that is not the great negotiating tool, though, that he expects it to be.
Well, I think Daniel takes it as an affront. Like, I'm not trying to become a millionaire instantly. I want to earn my millions.
Well, that's where we learn that maybe this is not about money.
It's not.
This is about power.
It also did crack me up that Union Oil is portrayed as like the friend of the independents.
Exactly.
When nowadays, you know, what was Union Oil is now the biggest oil company in the world.
Is that BP? Is that what we're talking about?
Chevron.
Oh, Chevron. Okay. Yeah, no, Standard Oil is BP for some part of that. Because, of course, Ohio became part of BP, but I don't know, Standard of California, was that all part of the deal? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Father would know. Father Anderson.
Because Standard Oil was a Rockefeller deal, right?
Oh, yeah, these are all the Robert... We can actually tie this into Kennecott at a certain point if we want, about the Copper Barons as well. This is all perfect Robert Baron times. So Standard Oil is totally... could be the great bad guy. But it's not... that's not what this movie is really about, though.
No.
Daniel, of course, elects to go through with this Union Oil thing and construct a pipeline, but the Bandy Ranch is still in the way. And to go around the Bandy Ranch would require like 50 miles and going through like mountains. Mm-hmm. So it really is important to get that. And of course, he's sort of offended the Bandy patriarch by not coming to see him originally. And so I guess when his partner says, well, you want me to go up and talk to him? He's like, no, I'll go up and talk to him myself, show you how it's done. And he takes his brother. And during this little adventure to go up to the Bandy property, that's when he, as they're reminiscing about childhood, Daniel is getting suspicious of Henry maybe not being who he says he is.
Yeah, well, they've had some really great bonding time. You know,
oh, yeah.
Sort of surveying in the pipeline route and making it all the way to the Pacific Ocean and having a final time swimming on the beach.
And talking about things. And but then the worm kind of turns when they end up at a saloon, and Henry gets just way crazy drunk and acting all a fool, and Daniel does not approve.
And asking for money, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's after Daniel's made a couple of references to Fond du Lac that Henry has not reciprocated.
Which is where they're from, ostensibly. Well, so then we have a little confrontation in the middle of the night where Daniel, well, let's just say it. He goes out and outright accuses Henry of not being who he says he is. At gunpoint.
And Henry, he seems like he's had a gun pointed at him before.
Oh, yeah.
Because he stays pretty calm. Yeah. I mean, he's scared. He wants to get out of the situation, but he doesn't freak out and scream and cry like I probably would if I woke up to a gun in my face.
Yeah. Well, and he's just asking. He's not even asking for anything other than just let me leave. Just let me leave. I will disappear. I made a mistake. He explains that he was a friend of the real Henry who died of tuberculosis. At least that's his story. But Daniel Plainview is not one to take treachery well. Because he shoots him in the head and kills him.
Yeah, he's just done with it.
Yeah. In cold blood, he kills him.
Yep.
And that, well, actually, mommy, I'm sorry, in hot blood. It was a hot-blooded killing. But, right. Yeah. Then he goes and digs a shallow grave.
No, I disagree. This was not a shallow grave.
No, he hit the water.
Yeah, he dug to groundwater.
Okay, well, hey, let me tell you. I could dig a shallow grave and hit groundwater in my backyard. I don't know about you. I could grow rice in my backyard, but we're not going to talk about that.
Daniel is no stranger to hard work. He when he has to dig a grave, he goes for it.
Exactly. When you absolutely positively have to dig a grave in a hurry.
He's very thorough.
Daniel Plainview, pickaxe. Ding! It's a trademark on the Plainview Pickaxe Corporation. So unfortunately, and he, of course, gets drunk, but he is awoken.
And he grieves. Oh, I can't tell if he's grieving for the fake brother that he lost, because he was actually spending a lot of quality time with him. Or if he's grieving for the real brother that he never got to meet, but
probably both.
Yeah, he's actually pretty torn up about it.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, it doesn't go well with his image either, so he has to reevaluate his own self.
Right.
Yeah. So he's drunk and is awoken the next morning by an old codger who turns out to be Mr. Bandy.
I love Mr. Bandy. I thought this actor was great.
He reminds me of Jerry Spence. Are you familiar with the attorney Jerry Spence?
No.
He's a California... Actually, no. He's probably not even a California attorney. He's probably like a Montana attorney. I think he represented or was one of the people that represented like the Randy Weaver folks from the Ruby Ridge. But he's defended a whole bunch of folks against big government. But anywhere's the typical, I guess it's the brown suede version of the car wash jacket with all the fringe on it. Sort of a southwest, well, maybe even like northwest kind of frontier garb.
Is he a white hair ponytail guy?
Yes, he is.
All right.
So, yeah.
That guy.
Exactly. Yeah, he's that guy. So that's how I thought of Mr. Bandy. But Mr. Bandy apparently has, he knows what happened the night before. And that and the fact that Plainview has a heck of a hangover puts Daniel Plainview at a very high disadvantage. And he even says, you know, because Bandy is like, he'd asked him to come and talk to him before when he was leasing land. And Plainview says, yeah, that's right. My boy's been very sick. And Bandy's like, that was before your boy got sick. So he's already putting him right on his heels.
Right.
But there's a deal to be made. And God told him what to do. And Bandy says that Plainview must be washed in the blood of Jesus Christ. And he tries to do this, what he's done before, do this Sarah Palin answer. But he's like, oh, I've been washed in the blood. I washed all the blood. Don't worry about it. Blood's taken care of.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, but I'll pay you $3,000. It's like, no, you have to join the church. It's like, I'll pay you $5,000. No, you'll be baptized and forgiven for the sin that you've done. It's like, well, what sin are you referring to? My sin of drilling? No, how about this? And hands him the murder weapon.
Yeah, that was such a great look. I mean, he doesn't say anything. He just kind of sighs and is like, all right, yeah. You're going to make me do this.
Exactly.
Yeah, and hands him his gun.
Yep. And that's where a big, bushy Western mustache hides a lot of grumbling. like you wonder why Yosemite Sam has a mustache like that. It's because he's doing a lot of talking there that we can lip read. Do you find that to be the case, Brother Jay?
I don't know. I'm not quite the mumble pants that other people are.
No, so. But we wouldn't. Well, you've got the beard. You can grumble.
I find that my disdain for people is much better when it's not hidden. So I don't bother with that kind of mumbling. If I don't like you, I'm right out about it. So,
just like Daniel Plainview,
sort of. Although in
with
church,
a bullet.
When he goes to church, that's when we have a pretty great scene where Eli Sunday gets to baptize Daniel Plainview.
Yeah, this is where Eli gets revenge.
Exactly,
because the slap fighting starts in reverse.
Yes, and. He tells Daniel that he's come and he's brought wealth and good, but he's also brought bad habits as a backslider. He's lusted after women, which, by the way, we have no evidence of.
Right.
And he's abandoned the child, your child that you raised. He abandoned him. And he makes Plainview say that he's a sinner. And he abandoned his child. He makes him say it over and over again as he is slapping Daniel Plainview.
And yeah.
But the end of it is perfect, because at the end of it, after he goes through the whole thing, he's like, Plainview, like, will dust himself off and says, okay, that's fine. Like, thank you, I did my job, goodbye now.
Yeah, as Eli is doing his preaching in the background after slapping the crap out of him and making him shout at the top of his lungs that he has abandoned his boy, you know, he actually mutters to himself, and there's the pipeline.
Exactly, yeah. That'll do, pig.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he basically traded this embarrassment for what he needed.
Yeah, seemingly a small price to pay for him.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So we get scenes of the pipeline being laid.
It's probably the cheapest land swap he's had.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Cash-wise. Oh,
and he still hasn't given the $5,000 to the church.
Oh, exactly, yeah. So HW returns and reunites with Daniel, and Eli leaves town to do missionary work.
And HW also slaps the crap out of Daniel.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. So then we skip forward again, and it's now 1927.
Oh, no, you skip past the bar scene.
Oh, I'm
yeah,
sorry.
The
where
restaurant.
He takes HW to the restaurant.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm
with
sorry. Yes, where he takes a napkin and puts it over his face so HW doesn't know he's talking. And because the Standard Oil guys come in to the bar as he and HW are having a big steak. A steak and whiskey and milk.
Yeah, and the bar owners or the servers, they start giving preferential treatment to the Standard Oil guys. And Daniel just cannot stand this.
Oh, no, not at all. So that's where he is putting the napkin over his face. And he is talking about how that Standard Oil had offered him $1 million. And he said, you know, no, now he's so much better for it. But he's flipped his chicken, though.
And then I'll drink your whiskey.
Yeah, he comes over. And he tells the guy he had threatened before to cut his throat. He's like, you know what I'll do. Yeah. Or I'm sorry, can you do it in your voice, Brother Jay?
You'll know what I'll do.
No, that's a little bit more Batman. Yeah.
You'll know what I do.
Blah, blah, blah.
Very nice.
That was Borat.
Yeah, it was. So anyway.
Okay.
My wife. So we go to 1927. And HW marries Mary Sunday.
Yep.
Which is pretty great. By the way, we did have this whole subtext where Daniel Plainview told or made sure that Mary's father didn't beat her anymore.
Yeah. Much to Mary's father's unhappiness.
Well, and also,
seems like he wanted to beat her.
Well, also, there was a creepy factor back in Little Boston when Daniel Playfield took Little Mary in his hands and talked about how her daddy doesn't beat her anymore. It's like,
with her daddy sitting at the same table.
Yes.
But there were several examples of H.W. and Mary being friends, because there's several scenes of them playing, and then she's observing when the teacher comes. She's learning sign language.
Yeah, there's like a whole montage of H.W. and Mary.
Mm-hmm. And there's several examples of her making note of the sign language and making signs to herself in the background to mimic what is going on between H.W. and the teacher.
That must be what repeated viewing gets you.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, no, yeah. Mary's learning sign language along with H.W.
So H.W. and Mary marry? And
yes, they do.
It's a very merry Mary Mary.
And Daniel is really wealthy and lives in a large mansion.
He's come completely off the rails.
Oh, yeah. He is a raging alcoholic. He's one of those traditional Western super rich alcoholic guys who has firearms and shoots inside the house. This, by the way, happens in our own hometown here and there. Shooting inside the house, not just for poor folk. In fact, rich folk get away with it better because nobody really complains. You can afford people to come and patch the holes in your wall.
It's just redecorating if you're rich.
Exactly, yeah.
I want that wall spackled.
Exactly. Pew. So pretty soon we get a scene between H.W. And his interpreter going to talk to Daniel about dissolving their partnership so that H.W. can go away and start his own oil company in Mexico. You know, kind of make a clean start, see what he can do, loves Mexico, you know, that kind of thing. And the elder Daniel Plainview, the old man Daniel Plainview, drunk old man Daniel Plainview, he still has his great voice and his great vocabulary. And he is also an asshole. As much as ever, but this time it's on more display. Where at first he's like, when his son, through the interpreter, says, "I'd like to speak to you in private." He's like, "You can't speak, so why don't you flap your hands about and have what's-his-name tell me what's going on? Or don't you know?"
Well, and then Daniel, because, you know, H.W. can't be without his man, Daniel refuses to have his consort leave the room as a kind of tit-for-tat.
Oh, yeah, well.
Like, if you want privacy, well, that's fine. You can't have it. If it were the two of us and we can talk. But if you're going to have your man, I'm going to have my man.
When H.W. says he wants to go to Mexico, Plainview's response is, "Well, that makes you my competitor. I can't do as good a voice." Yeah, so it devolves pretty quickly into, again, no opportunity is wasted to dog on the interpreter. H.W. says through the interpreter that he'd rather keep you as my father than my partner. He's like, "Well, then say it. You got something to say? I'd like to hear you speak instead of your little dog. Woof, 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 woof."
He's so great, but it's such a horrible person at this moment.
Oh, yeah.
This whole scene is particularly heartbreaking considering like how much he has doted on H.W. up until this point in the movie.
Yeah, and so he forces H.W. to say it himself. And what does he say? "Can you do it? Anybody jump on this one?" The words are, "I'm going to Mexico with my wife. I'm going away from you."
"I don't know what you're talking about. It sounded just like that."
"I'm going away to Mexico with my wife."
"You're going to hell."
"No, I'm already going to hell. I'm going to go to hell with a better accent than this. You guys can pull this off, but no. I'm going away from you." I can't do it. That's not great.
So bad.
Sorry, I'll do my...
He's deaf. He's not tongueless.
You know, you reach this moment where H.W. is coming to say he's leaving, and I think Daniel realizes that he's probably not going to live long enough to see Daniel again. And so the only way he can mask his pain and sorrow of losing his son is to basically just shun him and disconnect.
Yeah, reveals to him that... he's not even his father.
Not only that, but you're a bastard from a basket. A bastard from a basket. A bastard from a basket.
A tisket, a tasket, bastard from a basket.
That's how mean-spirited he is. He's yelling at the deaf guy, even as the deaf guy is walking away.
Exactly.
Well, he's innately self-centered at this point. But it turns out he was probably largely self-centered throughout.
Oh, he's a narcissist for the entire movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that at this point, you question all of his father choices, you know, his parenting choices. He spells it out. Look, you're an orphan from a basket, and I took you for no other reason than I needed a sweet face to buy land.
Yeah, you were an accessory.
La croix, sweetie.
You're a bastard from a basket. A bastard from a basket. Which, by the way, that should have been the line that stuck forever. The milkshake line is great, but the bastard from a basket is like the more like from the heart kind of line.
Yeah, it's not nearly as funny, though.
No, not at all, yeah.
I drink your milkshake.
Exactly, yeah. Well,
it's not as discordant.
Well, Jimmy Fallon couldn't just, like, in the middle of lip-sync battles, talk about the bastard from the basket. But everybody can drink anybody else's milkshake. Yeah, so now, you know, Daniel is burning bridges. He has everything he wants as far as he lives in a big house, and he's got lots of money, and he's very successful.
He's got a boss bowling alley in his house.
Yeah, for 1937?
Too bad he sleeps in the gutter.
Literally.
Yeah.
There's some symbolism.
It's great. This is when Eli shows up. And again, this is where this movie is great, because everything is kind of bookended. Eli shows up and visits Daniel, who's all passed out. And basically the butler lets him in. And Eli is as smug as ever.
Yeah.
But turns out he's come to ask for money.
Yeah, so Daniel forces Eli into some full submission.
Oh, it's great. At first, he tears Eli down by saying that it was really his brother. Like, Eli was the weak brother. The strong mm-hmm. brother, Paul, he was the one that won.
And got the $10,000.
Yes, yes. Although it's funny, because that actually wasn't true, was it?
No.
Yeah, they didn't like pay him $10,000.
$500,
yeah,
right?
He told Eli that he paid him $10,000 cash in hand like this. But yeah, I think that was a lie. But he tells him, you know, he has his own company now, very prosperous little business, 3 wells producing, $5,000 a week. And that's where Eli starts to cry. Which is a tactical error.
Blood in the yes, water.
Yes, but Eli is trying to sell him a lease on the Bandy land because Elder Bandy has died. And Eli knows that there is a ton of oil to be produced from the Bandy land.
Of course. It's a big, big property, right? And of course, Plainview is really dogging on Eli's being the lesser of the twins. Talking about how when Paul was sucking at his mother's teat, where were you? Who was nursing you? One of the Bandy sows.
Calls him afterbirth.
Yes. And Eli is, you know, he's like, I just, you know, if you would just take, you know, the land and give us the money for the church. He's like you lose. He's like,
yeah, Eli wants what, $100,000 finder's fee, and the $5,000 that he was supposed to pay the exactly. church plus interest.
Yeah, I want my $2.
Just let the $5,000 go. He told you he'd bury you in the ground.
Oh yeah, and that's where we get the great milkshake line, which is really fantastic. It's the whole thing.
But not before he makes Eli swear that God doesn't exist.
Yes, yes, that's true.
That no. He's just a charlatan.
He's a false prophet.
Yes. He's a false prophet.
And say it over and over, just like Eli made him say that he abandoned his child.
Yeah.
So he talks about how, yeah, you know, Eli had this bottom card he would play. Turns out it's called drainage. If you own all the property around it, you drink other people. Yeah. You drink the other milkshake.
I'll drink your milkshake. I'll drink it all up.
Yeah, he goes back to that that same monotone at first after Eli has sort of done his deed and screamed that he's a false prophet and that God is a superstition. And then he's finally like, there's no more oil. I've drilled it all. And then he explains drainage. And yes. Eli just starts to crumble into a heap and cry some more.
Well, Eli doesn't get it at first. It takes a while to sink in.
Yeah, hence the milkshake metaphor.
Yes, and he's literally shrinking at this point. Because, you know, Plainview may be drunk, but he's still an imposing figure. And so he says, don't bully me, Daniel. And so Daniel, like, throws him across the room and tells him that, do you think your song and dance and your superstition will help you, Eli? I am the third revelation. I am who the Lord has chosen.
Daniel is such a hilarious drunk.
He is. Yes. Yes. He flips his chicken, though. And he chases him around the bowling room. Eventually, though, things go
the
poorly.
The bowling for room? You mean the bowling alley?
It's like a basketball ring.
Dude, that's where I was going with it. You beat me to the punch.
Sorry. Sorry.
I guess that would be an alley-oop. I kind of set that joke for you.
Yes.
All right. I'm reading right directly from the notes from IMDb that call it the bowling room, so fuck you both. IMDb is never wrong. Except for when it is. So then, Daniel ends up killing Eli by smashing him in the head with a bowling pin. They are called bowling pins, right?
Yes.
Okay.
No, they're bowling dowels.
Yeah. You ever seen duck pin bowling? Like,
no.
Like half height pins and balls that have no holes, little balls that have no holes. I think it's an East Coast thing.
Okay. No, never seen it.
Okay.
Anyway. Is this something you had, like, maybe in a fever dream?
Oh, I believe duck pin bowling is a real thing.
Okay.
I can do my due diligence. I think
my mother believed Eric Estrada was surrounded by chickens and was dead, so.
No, I'm pretty sure there's a duck pin bowling scene in Seraphim Falls.
I was thinking, actually, that on his fourth album, my favorite rapist and reggae artist, Snow, did a whole song on duck pin bowling. It's called Strike, Mon.
A waiting anyway. Joke for what?
Yeah, not even. Yeah. So, after killing Eli, the butler comes down and finds Daniel laying next to Eli on the bowling lane.
Butler seems pretty unalarmed by this happenstance.
Yes. And that's when Daniel says the final line of the movie, I'm finished.
Yeah, how many bodies has the butler buried?
Exactly.
It makes you wonder.
Because he is cool as cucumber.
Yeah, he is. Yes, he is. So, Brother Jay, your verdict.
This is a great movie. It's a great movie on rewatch, and it's a great movie.
What's the message of this movie?
There's too many. There's too many pivots of this movie, but you know, it's.
How am I supposed to feel at the end of the movie?
I don't know. How do you feel at the end of this movie? That's the better question.
I wasn't sure.
Oh,
I wasn't sure whether it was Much Ado About Nothing. Like a really stylish movie that was basically kind of a character piece, or if there was a message that I just didn't quite get. I mean, it is about the greed. Is it like a anti-capitalism, anti?
No, I don't believe that. Because at the end of it, HW walks away and basically out to start on his own, which is, you know, that's a great message. He's not afraid to go out and fail. And, you know, knowing that he's basically being cut off from his father and likely the empire of his father, meaning the money, you know, he's still going to go out with his wife and he's going to start a life and he's going to try and make it for himself because that's what he saw his father do.
Drew, what's the message of this movie?
I think I think one of the messages is sort of be careful what you wish for. And I don't mean that in like in as cliched a way as that sounds, but I think there's this notion when you sort of look at super rich people and you see them like still grinding. You know, specifically folks who have not inherited wealth, they tend to work and work and work even after they're super rich. And I think most people would look at that and think, man, if I had that much money, I would never work again. But that's sort of the whole point is if you have that attitude, then you don't have it in you to make that much money. And I think this movie sort of shows that to be as mercenary as you needed to be back then to make it as an independent oil man in a world of Standard Oil and Union Oil, you had to have these sort of tragic flaws that enabled you to grind it out and do the things that were necessary to be successful in that kind of business. But ultimately, that corrupts you to the point where it doesn't matter what you gain and how successful you are, you'll never be happy and you'll be a tortured soul for your entire life.
Well, and I think, you know, from the beginning of it, when you see Daniel trying to attain his goal of whatever he's after from the silver or the mining into the oil, you know, he has many, many, many opportunities to just be rich and quit, but never does. And so you never know quite, well, what is his motivation? His motivation doesn't seem to be money, because he can have money at any point that he wants. It's that he wants to be producing these wells and he wants to be beating Standard Oil. He wants to be making sure he's there first and that he lets everybody know of his success and that this is what he does. And so he wants to make sure that it's his name and his wells and his processes and his pipeline, all of that. He wants his, you know, that his empire is what he really wants to create. And it isn't about the money. It's about the empire.
He's driven to succeed, but there is no success that will ever satisfy him.
Correct.
And that's why even at the end of the movie, after he's finally gotten his ultimate revenge on Eli, probably the person who has humiliated him the most in his life, in such a public manner, he gets the ultimate revenge on him. You still don't get the feeling that he is satisfied and happy with what's going on. He's just finished.
Yeah.
And ready to move on to the next thing.
It's just done.
So it's not about all the oil, it's not about all the money. He must drink other people's milkshakes.
Yep.
Yes.
So if there aren't other people whose milkshakes to drink, it wouldn't be satisfying.
Right.
Well, and that's the problem, is that there's always somebody else with another milkshake out there. So no matter how many he drinks, he's still got to get to work.
Hmm. So he's a tragic figure.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. So, Drew, was it worth it?
I think it was absolutely worth it. I mean, it was certainly a time commitment, and this was the definition of a slow burn. I mean, you called The Gift a slow burn, but this movie really takes its time, but with a fantastic payout, I think. I watched this movie in chunks, so I watched a big chunk on Sunday during the day. I watched another little chunk Sunday night, and then I watched another chunk Monday at lunch. And you know, I'd seen the movie before, so I knew the beats to expect. And with about 30 minutes left, which was going to be the last chunk I watched Monday night, there was still a shit ton that had to happen in the movie. So there was this long, long lead up. And then the last half hours is just totally bonkers. So much happens in the last half hour that made the experience so worth it. And it's such a unique movie. I don't know of any other movie like this. And we've barely talked about the score and the overall sound design that you mentioned in the beginning. that just adds a whole nother layer to it, you know, aside from the great acting performances. So absolutely, I think it was worth it. I would do it again if I had unlimited time.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the other thing about a 2.5 hour plus movie is that, you know, my first thought is, okay, what could you edit out of it? But arguably, there's no part of this movie that you could lose and still have the effect. You need that slow burn. You need to see him. You can't just start with him talking to Paul F. Tompkins. You need him falling down that shaft.
All of it is important because it builds the momentum and gains the gravity of him.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I mean, all hats off to Daniel Day-Lewis because if he's not in every scene, he's in like maybe there's one scene without him in it. Maybe the montage with HW getting married. But otherwise, yep, he is on screen for the entire 2.5 hours and pulls it off by power of mustache alone.
And at no point in this movie did I ever think, for me anyway, and this isn't a dig on you, I'm just saying it never looked to me like he was Daniel Day-Lewis. I only saw Daniel Plainview.
Oh, exactly, yeah. No, the voice. It was the voice. Because, you know, turns out Daniel Day-Lewis is an Englishman.
Yeah.
Did you know his dad wrote spy novels?
No.
Is he Irish?
Maybe. Sorry.
English or Irish?
I'll have to find that out. Maybe he's Irish.
My Left Foot, I think, is the first Daniel Day-Lewis movie I saw.
Yeah. I know that Jackie Cation refers to his father as Daniel Dad Lewis because he's Daniel Day-Lewis's dad.
Very, very witty.
Yeah.
Born in London. Daniel Day-Lewis is the second child of Cecil Day-Lewis, a.k.a. Nicholas Blake, a poet laureate of England.
Oh, well, here you go.
Poet laureate. Nice.
Yeah. Nicholas Blake. What a boss spy novel writer name. So he was Cecil Lewis as the poet laureate and Nick Drake as the pulp fiction writer. That's every author's dream. That's Richard Bachman and Stephen King.
No, he played Lincoln.
Oh, no. If he didn't win an Academy Award for Lincoln, he was up for it.
Wow.
Yeah.
He won it for this movie, right?
Yes, he did.
I think he won for My Left Foot as well, if I don't...
Yeah, is he a 3-time Oscar winner?
I think so.
He would be one of the only. He was in Remains of the Day, right? Wasn't that before My Left Foot?
Never seen it. He was in The Name of the Father. Yeah. Saw that in the theater together.
Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah. Oh, I saw that, or part of that, on a bus in Mexico. On a cross-country bus.
That's a Michael Mann movie.
Let's see. I'm sorry, what movie were you asking about?
Remains of the Day.
The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Remains of the Day was Anthony Hopkins. Emma Thompson.
You're skipping over Gangs in New York.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Bill the Butcher.
I've never seen that movie either.
The only male actor in history to have won 3 wins in the lead actor category. And one of only 3 male actors to win 3 Oscars.
Are you thinking maybe The Age of Innocence?
Maybe. No, I think it's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Who else was in that? Amanda Pays or something. Juliette Binoche. There we go. Lena Olin. Okay.
Lena Olin. From Romeo is Bleeding, right?
Yes, Romeo is Bleeding. Absolutely.
Yeah. With or without?
The Unbearable Lightness of Being, 1988. In 1968, a Czech doctor with an active sex life meets a woman who wants monogamy. Then the Soviet invasion further disrupts their lives. That's hilarious. So, so There Will Be Blood. Like I said, it's a thinker. I may have to watch it again.
I would highly recommend watching it again.
Yeah, because I mean, I love the Daniel Plainview character, but yeah, he is a tragic figure. So you don't aspire to be Daniel Plainview.
No, even if you have to watch it in parts, it's still a great movie. You'll get so much more out of it the second or third time. At least I did. I mean, I would hope, but because I know I've gotten stuff out of it successively. So
it's a trifecta. It's one of the we should somehow catalog movies that we all liked versus movies that some of us liked and other of us didn't. There should be something on a pivot table for that.
Well, we would have to go back and discuss the movies that we did in separate podcasts.
Well, yeah.
Or we will have to have formed some kind of survey.
Yeah, there we go. So if somebody can come up with the survey.
Seems like a pretty simple survey. A list of episodes.
Yeah.
Did you like this movie? Yes or no?
Exactly, yeah. No, I'm not saying it's going to be intricate. So, yeah, hey, I would recommend There Will Be Blood. I would recommend... oh, by the way, this was written by Paul Thomas Anderson, but it was also written by Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation and Reefer Madness.
Yeah, but this is based on an Upton Sinclair novel, Oil.
Well, after Eric Schlosser wrote Fast Food Nation, people just assumed that he was a big fan of Upton Sinclair, who wrote, what was it called? Savage something or other about the meat industry. And so he hadn't read any of Upton Sinclair, so he read everything. And he wanted to adapt There Will Be Blood. And then Paul Thomas Anderson turns out to have wanted to do it as well. And then when Daniel Day-Lewis was approached to be Daniel Plainview, he said yes before he even read the script because he liked Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch-Drunk Love so much.
Wow.
So that's pretty
good. That's pretty brave.
Yeah. It makes me want to watch Lincoln.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
Yeah, me either.
So.
Seems long.
Yeah, makes me want to watch Gangs of New York. Also seems long. Actually, does he do any short movies?
Probably not.
Yeah, at a certain point, you're not going to get Daniel Day-Lewis to make a cameo in, like, Zoolander 2.
Well, you never know.
He'd be great in the sequel to Tropic Thunder, though.
Exactly, yeah. Get him in blackface.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's been done. He'd have to do something else.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.